It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, 27,000 emails were released today linked to the John Doe investigation. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is reporting that among those, an email has been found linking Governor Scott Walker to a secret chain of emails in his Milwaukee County Executive Office.
First, though, Hillary Clinton's public image during the past 20 years has seen its highs and lows. She's been up and down in the polls. She's achieved big successes and suffered significant failures.
One thing, however, is for certain. Clinton was a popular Secretary of State. And since she left that post a year ago, no one can stop talking about her potential 2016 presidential campaign.
In the aftermath of her 2008 loss for the Democratic nomination, most people thought all that was over. She'd lost to Barack Obama, and it was time to set her sights elsewhere. In their new biography of Hillary Clinton, Politico White House Bureau Chief Jonathan Allen and The Hill White House correspondent Amy Parnes chart her unlikely comeback. Their biography titled HRC was published last week, and Jonathan and Amy are here with us now. Jonathan, welcome to Central Time.
I'm happy to be on Central Time, and I've always wanted to say hello, Wisconsin. Thank you for indulging me in that. And one other thing, I've actually recently moved to Bloomberg News, so I just wanted to get my new employer's name.
Gotcha. Let's get that in there. And Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Well, let's get it out of the way. Is Hillary going to run for president in 2016?
I think it's pretty certain. I think we're 99.9% sure she runs. Something pretty significant would have to happen for her to stay out of this race. You know, the whole landscape is set up for her. She has fundraising groups, research groups, everything just waiting on her to just say, yes, I'm in. And we think it's pretty inevitable.
Jonathan, if anything were to stand in her way and prevent her from doing it, what would that thing be?
You know, it's hard to see. I mean, you know, the way that we've looked at it, and we write about this in the book, is that this operation has been moving toward a 2016 presidential run for, well, since the end of the 2008 campaign. She's been building her machine and her operation while at the State Department, and also President Clinton out on the campaign trail, you know, for Democratic candidates and settling some old scores and helping Barack Obama win re-election. You know, we look at it as a question not of whether she'll start running, but whether she'll stop, and the question of what could get in her way. I mean, obviously there are personal considerations. You know, if there were some sort of health issue, perhaps. You know, if polling started coming back showing that she didn't have any chance, I suppose that's a possibility. You know, but all systems seem to be go.
Well, let's start by playing a clip from one of Hillary Clinton's most popular speeches, her 2008 concession speech.
You can be so proud that from now on, it will be unremarkable for a woman to win primary state victories. Unremarkable to have a woman in a close race to be our nominee. Unremarkable to think that a woman can be the president of the United States. And that is truly remarkable, my friends. To those who are disappointed that we couldn't go all the way, especially the young people who put so much into this campaign, it would break my heart if, in falling short of my goal, I in any way discouraged any of you from pursuing yours. Always aim high, work hard, and care deeply about what you believe in. And when you stumble, keep faith. And when you're knocked down, get right back up and never listen to anyone who says you can't or shouldn't go on.
And a clip there from Hillary Clinton's 2008 concession speech. And it says something, Jonathan, doesn't it, when one of your most popular speeches as a politician is a concession speech? What does that say about Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think, you know, there are a couple things here. Number one, it's actually not all that unusual for concession speeches to be among the best speeches of campaigns because they're the one time where candidates are very humble, and I think that comes off well with voters, you know, where they tend to have, you know, they talk about the things that motivated them, and they talk about their supporters, and so I think people like that. I think, you know, one of the fascinating things about that concession speech, and we talk about this a lot in the book, is, you know, she had not really embraced her her place in women's history, her part of the women's movement, and yet there were so many people, you know, before that speech, and there were so many people who were drawn to her campaign, at least in part because of that. And we have a scene in the book where she sits down at her dining room table to write the last draft of that speech the night before the speech with a couple of her very close aides. And, you know, some of those refrains are in there, some of those things about putting 18 million cracks in the glass ceiling and you know, what it means to be part of, you know, a movement were in there. And Hillary Clinton actually wrote a question mark next to them in the margin and said, this really wasn't about me being a woman. And her advisor sort of had to talk her into the importance of finally embracing that the historical nature of her candidacy, which she had tried so hard not to do. And I think a lot of people in the Democratic primary think that that was a mistake. I mean, Barack Obama very much embraced the historical nature of his own candidacy. It very much appealed to a lot of Democrats. And so, you know, ultimately she was won over by a young speechwriter named Sarah Hurwitz, who went on to be a speechwriter for Barack Obama, who kind of made the case that you really need to do this. It's time to do this. And so, you know, I think there were a lot of people who were her supporters who were very moved by that decision. I think if she runs in 2016, she'll be a lot more embracing of that element of the campaign than she was in the past. And, you know, I think especially for women of Hillary Clinton's generation, I think there's such a, in the professional world, such a feeling, a sense of a mandate to not call attention to being a woman. You know, as they were the sort of trailblazers in the boardrooms and in politics, and to, you know, trying to get along in sort of a man's world, never thought that it was necessarily a good thing to embrace that. And now, you know, politically, what you're seeing is a real change, not so much in the people, but in the people who are the candidates or the trailblazers, but a change in our society where that's a much more sort of welcome thing, and you know, it's part of her story.
Let's get at that a little more. Amy, what did it mean at that turning point when she did decide to embrace the fact of her being a woman as something that was significant and that she wanted to hold up and be an emblem for women everywhere and, you know, align herself with iconic Black women like Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman? What did that change for her when that happened?
Oh, you know, I think it. She heard a lot about this in the summer after, you know, we talk about this one speech that John just mentioned, but I think she really learned her lesson that summer where when she called aides to her house and to her Senate office and she said, what went wrong here? How can we fix this? Tell me what happened. And most people said, you know, or a lot of people said that, you know, you didn't really embrace the fact that you are this woman candidate, that it was like this historic event. And so I think should she run in 2016, we are going to see a much different Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail. She's going to embrace all these ideas. She's already taken up women's issues along with her daughter. They've been, you know, going around the country touting these issues. So I think it's definitely going to be a big part of her campaign in 2016.
So Barack Obama prevailed in that 2008 nomination bid because, in part, he'd mastered technology. He came on a message of change. And at the time, the Clintons had been, you know, sort of up and down in public opinion. And there was a sense in a way that there was Clinton fatigue, that maybe people had sort of had enough and wanted a fresh face. But she came back from that, and her popularity again now as Secretary of State, and she's just kept moving up in profile and esteem. How did that happen? How did she turn that around, Jonathan?
Well, I think part of it is, you know, just in accepting Barack Obama's offer to become Secretary of State, there is a sort of statement of loyalty to him, to the party, to the country. You know, she talks about, in the book, she talks about how she would have wanted him to work for her had she been the one that was nominated and eventually elected president, and would have, you know, been upset if had he, you know, declined that. So she tried to put herself in his shoes, and so I think that that had something to do with it right off the bat. You know, you saw her approval ratings rise, you know, pretty much immediately after the primary. They started going up, and she sustained in the 60s for percent approval rating for much of her time at state. I think a big part of that was being out of the sort of basic domestic political fray. I mean, we write in the book about some of the things she actually got involved in behind the scenes domestically, but from a public perspective, she wasn't fighting on the stimulus. She wasn't fighting publicly on the health care law, these things that really sort of bogged the president's numbers down. And look, her job as Secretary of State was to go around the world and sell America. It's hard hard for that to be unpopular with the American public.
We're speaking right now with Jonathan Allen of Bloomberg News and Amy Parnes, White House correspondent for The Hill, about their new book, HRC. It charts Hillary Rodham Clinton's unlikely political comeback. We're back now with Jonathan Allen of Bloomberg News and Amy Parnes, White House correspondent for The Hill, talking about their new book, HRC, which charts Hillary Clinton's political comeback. And if you have questions about Hillary Clinton's career, her comeback, or maybe a possible 2016 run, you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org. And Amy, one of the things that Hillary Clinton changed when she was first lady to husband President Bill Clinton, she really got in there and got involved with issues. And it seems people were taken aback at first that here was a first lady who was so hands-on, clearly had her own ambitions, and people really weren't sure how to make sense of that. And now I wonder, has she changed the mold for what's expected of first ladies?
Yeah, I think she suffered a little bit as a result of healthcare, for instance. But you know, there's a scene in the book that we talk about. She didn't really speak much about healthcare, for example, publicly, because she saw that it had sort of hurt her during her husband's administration. But you know, behind the scenes, she was really rallying for the president's cabinet to get behind the healthcare reform bill and support it. You know, it was in the middle of the Tea Party summer, and they all had their own agendas to push, and she recalled her husband's time, and she said, "Come on, you guys, this is, you know, this is our moment to do this." And we also found out in the book that we write about the fact that she was calling lawmakers. She was really, really pushing for this to happen. So I think that she, you know, she learned her lesson. She definitely didn't want to have her fingerprints on this publicly, but she played a very big role privately.
She didn't want to have her fingerprints on it publicly, and yet it seemed like the worst-kept secret that she was really behind this.
It hadn't really been reported. We reveal this in our book because, you know, I remember at the time I was actually asking people, well, what's Hillary Clinton's role in this? And they said, oh, she's very much staying out of it. So it's interesting to see exactly what kind of role and how big a role she played in this.
And in terms, Jonathan, of her tenure as Secretary of State, she's a high-profile role. I think a lot of people were surprised that she would sign on with Barack Obama. It seemed like there was animosity between them as, you know, he was the young upstart and she was, you know, the one who was next in line and he got in the way, but yet she signed on. And she did more than that. She got on board behind him. What did that mean for her career? And what did that say about what it meant to her to be a politician?
I think it very much helped her position herself for 2016. The truth is that right after the campaign ended, she had some time to, even in the last weeks and months of the campaign to sort of accept that she wasn't going to win. And I think, one of the harder things was to get her supporters to a place where they saw Barack Obama as the person to support and to back. And in fact, we have a scene in the book where they're aboard a plane together, Obama and Clinton, on the way to Unity, New Hampshire. And she says to him, I'm behind you 100%. I'll do everything I can to help you win. My husband will. The harder thing is going to be to get all my supporters behind you. And so I think, you know, the president watched that play out over those months in the summer of her really working to help him win election. Even Bill Clinton, I think he was much more engaged and happy to be engaged in 2012 than he was in 2008, but in 2008 sort of worked for the president. And, by the time Obama actually offered her the job, and then it was sort of out there in the news and in the public that it was that she was deliberating about it, there came a time where it would have been really politically devastating to both President Obama and to her if she had turned him down. First, turning him down would have made him look bad after he talked about a team of rivals. And then, you know, by making him look bad and weakening him as he walked into office, I think she would have devastated herself with the Democratic primary electorate for the future. In a way, he'd sort of created a checkmate situation politically, or a shotgun wedding. You know, you use the metaphor that you like. But, if she wanted to continue in politics, I think she probably didn't have a choice. It wasn't like a couple years in, that she was going to sit on the sidelines and then a couple years into his administration launch a primary campaign against him the way that Ted Kennedy did against Jimmy Carter in 1980. That was something that's, still fresh enough in the Democratic Party's collective memory that that it's basically a non-starter to do something like that. So, you know, I think she had the choice of staying on the sidelines and not getting involved, but it would have been devastating to her. By contrast, by going in and working for him, I think she really helped get the Democratic Party behind her, and even a lot of Obama people more recently are now starting to work in her direction. Jim Messina has just joined Priorities USA, the 2012 Obama campaign manager. That organization is dedicated to helping Hillary Clinton should she jump in, and there are certain other folks in the Obama world that have signed on with her. So the short answer after that long-winded answer is she really helped herself by saying yes.
So are they genuinely friends now? I don't know if it matters, but is that bond there?
I think that they're, they are, someone put it to us in the book as, you know, they're like office friends, work friends. She's not over there, you know, having a beer with him in the evenings. But they really, they've come around to really like each other and respect each other. I think they both respected each other coming into it. I just think they needed to kind of work out some kinks and get through it. I think her side more than his side, obviously, because they were the winners. And, you know, a lot of her aides kind of harbored this bitterness towards the Obama people for quite some time.
Now, Hillary Clinton, should she run in 2016, which you think that she will, both of you, she's not coming with a completely clean slate. She has had the Benghazi scandal dogging her for a while. If she does choose to run, what do you see as the impact from that? The dust really hasn't completely settled on that, Jonathan.
Well, it hasn't completely settled in that the Republicans have made clear that that's something that they're going to bring up time and again. We talked to the Republican National Committee spokesman, Sean Spicer, and he was referring to us about an ad that they had cut actually in the 2012 campaign to use against President Obama on Benghazi that the Romney campaign told the RNC to not put out there. It has since been put out there as an ad against Hillary Clinton, and he said if she runs, she should get used to seeing it. So, I think from a political perspective, that's something that she definitely is going to have to deal with. If any readers are looking for, a timeline on what happened with Benghazi, you know, all the stuff beforehand, the night of Benghazi, what was going on at the State Department as that was unfolding in Libya, and even the aftermath, the talking points, the hearings, how this was approached by the folks in the administration, including Hillary Clinton, how it was approached by the news media, how it was approached by the Republican senators and House members that were investigating. You know, I think one of the things that our book does is sort of put that all together for folks that were getting the sort of news bits here and there. And I think we do, at the risk of sounding a little self-congratulatory here, I think we did a really good job of sort of putting all of that together in one place that people can read through pretty easily and get a sense of what really happened.
Going on to her image in a broader sense, we'll have to be thinking about this again should she run in 2016. And she seemed to mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. In 2008, something people said a lot was that she was polarizing. And she's got a new identity now, having had a second career. But as a person becomes more popular, sometimes they become more of a symbol than a person. Is that a danger for her as she moves forward?
No, I think, I think that she has to fight, obviously, she more than anyone. You know, they have this whole big long history that follows them wherever they go. She's definitely going to be fighting this baggage that comes with her and comes with her husband. You know, we're seeing that. We saw that last week with these papers that were unveiled, from her friend Diane Blair. You know, Republicans are trying to make this an issue, but I think it's actually something that they need to try to figure out if they're going to use that strategy against her. You know, you have some people like Reince Priebus, the head of the RNC, basically saying, oh, yeah, this is a really effective strategy. Everything is fair game. But then you have other people like Karl Rove saying this isn't, there's so much we could focus on right now. She was in charge of, Benghazi, for instance, was like at her, under her tenure, and this healthcare issue that we brought up earlier. So I think, she's going to have to deal with all of that.
Now, Jonathan, our last 30 seconds, if 2016 brings about a run with Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton, what do we need to be prepared for? What would that look like?
You know, it's interesting. These two get along so well. After the 2008 Democratic Convention speech that she gave, and we detailed this scene in the book a little better, but last 30 seconds, Joe Biden rushed to her holding room and fell to his knees and raised his arms in praise of her. These two are really good friends. They get along. I don't think you'd see a particularly combative race between them. You know, whether other Democrats get engaged and decide to run is another question.
Did you see him on the same ticket?
You know, I do think that I like to muse that Vice President Biden would like to be the permanent vice president, like a permanent quarterback in a pickup football game. You know, I don't know. Maybe Secretary of State.
All right, Jonathan and Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for
having us. Our pleasure. Take care.
That was Jonathan Allen with Bloomberg News and Amy Parnes, White House correspondent for The Hill, talking about their new book, HRC, about Hillary Rodham Clinton. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, and today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our On Congress segment with USA Today Congress and political editor Paul Singer. He'll fill us in on what's happening in Washington, D.C.
But first, we're talking about the latest in the John Doe investigation. Today, 27,000 emails were released to the public. The emails are from a convicted former aide to Governor Scott Walker.
The release is part of that probe dubbed the John Doe investigation. Prosecutors are trying to determine if Walker's aides were working on his 2010 gubernatorial campaign while working under him as Milwaukee County executive.
The release of these documents is getting national attention because many pundits consider Governor Walker to be a presidential contender in 2016. Democratic groups across the nation are drawing attention to the document dump. A spokesperson for the Democratic Governors Association wished reporters, quote, happy digging.
And here to discuss how this document release could have a ripple effect on the national scene is Elizabeth Titus. She's a political reporter for Politico. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And let's start with the basics. We've been following this story in Wisconsin, of course, but those who haven't been keeping up necessarily, what is the John Doe investigation?
Sure. Well, it was a probe that went on for about 3 years in Wisconsin and ended last year. It resulted in charges against six people who had connections in some way to Governor Scott Walker. And much of the investigation focused on whether Walker aides used their time on the clock working for the public in county government or whatnot to participate in political activity or to help political candidates run for office. And like I said, the probe was closed last year, but a court ordered that many, many emails from the investigation be released, and that's what happened today, which shed a lot of light on some of the people involved in Scott Walker's world.
And to be clear, that initial probe was not into Governor Walker himself. It was into staffers around him that were working on his campaign while they were actually employees of the Milwaukee County Executive's Office.
Right. Governor Walker has said that he never believed that he himself was a target of this investigation. And of course, he was not ever charged with any wrongdoing. But several people either close to him or who had contributed to his campaign, a variety of people, these six who were charged, did end up getting implicated in some of these issues.
So the latest news on these released emails just happening today is that they tie Governor Walker to the secret email system that was used in his county executive office, that there was this parallel system that was known about, but there's actually at least one email that they have found that shows that appears to show that Governor Walker knew about this system, which he has denied. How do you think this will impact his national standing?
Well, this is certainly getting more attention today in Washington, D.C. and in the national political media than I've seen it receive at any previous point. Obviously, this has been a big topic in Wisconsin, but I think you are seeing it start to break through a little bit. And, you know, in New Jersey with Governor Chris Christie there fighting a traffic scandal, you can see how an investigation close to any governor or any prominent politician, especially one like Governor Walker, who might have 2016 hopes, how that can really distract them from their message, how that can keep the media focused on things other than the governor's agenda, how it can create a little bit of a circus atmosphere. And that makes it very, very difficult for anyone who might be looking to create a roadmap to run for president in 2016.
And we do want to point out that it's according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporting that earlier this afternoon that at least one email has been found. But right now, that's all we know. And you brought up Chris Christie and how he responded when there when evidence came out that he was aware of the traffic stoppages and things like that. Do you think because Chris Christie has just gone through this, another potential Republican candidate for president, now Scott Walker is facing potentially a similar situation, do you think it's going to get more or less attention because of the Christie situation?
Well, that's a great question. I think that folks paying attention to the next presidential race are certainly primed to hear about and learn about stories similar to Christie's because it has been such a revealing episode there in New Jersey. I don't know, you know, there are a number of factors that make New Jersey and Wisconsin different. There's not quite the media market saturation. There's not the proximity to D.C. and New York where you have, you know, easy access to cable news shows and whatnot. But the Walker thing does seem to be breaking through, and I don't know to what extent he might be taking cues from Chris Christie or not about how to handle this, but for Democrats, national Democrats, it certainly makes for a very easy narrative. You know, here's one Republican governor, Chris Christie, fighting multiple investigations, and now here's Scott Walker. And of course, Republican governors would insist that they're getting very good results in their states, and they would dispute that sort of notion of a pattern.
Does this situation make Wisconsin more interesting to people who watch politics on a national level, or you know, does it make us look like we're, you know, just another bunch of kind of corrupt people? We just happen to be in the middle of the country instead of on one of the coasts.
Well, I think that's a great question, and time will tell. What I can say from covering, you know, the situation in New Jersey and from watching some of these things play out is that people get very interested, political junkies get very interested when there are documents they can hold and sift through and read, primary documents like the ones released today, and that seems to pique a lot of people's interest. And so if, you know, history is any indication there, I would say that people are definitely tuning into what's happening in Wisconsin. And of course, there was tons of attention back when the national attention back when the recall took place that has since quieted down a bit. And there could be a bit of a revival happening here, but time will ultimately tell.
Well, we will certainly keep tabs on this issue, as we're sure that you will as well. Elizabeth, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
That was Elizabeth Titus, reporter for Politico. It's time now for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today's Congress and Politics editor, Paul Singer. You can find him here at this time every Wednesday.
The Congressional Budget Office released its prediction yesterday of what would happen to the American economy if the minimum wage was raised to $10.10 an hour.
Also, this past Monday marked the fifth anniversary of President Obama's 2009 stimulus bill, and members of Congress duked it out over what the legacy of that bill should be.
Paul, it's great to have you back with us.
Well, great to be here. Thanks.
So what did the Congressional Budget Office have to say about how that $10.10 an hour minimum wage hike could affect the economy?
Well, they said two things that caught a lot of attention. The first thing they said is that it could cost 500,000 jobs if you raise the minimum wage $10.10, because the cost of the workforce will simply require people to scale back their hiring. The other half of what they said is that it would increase the standard of living for people who are getting those wages, lifting something like 900,000 people out of poverty and raising the wages for, I think, like 16 million people. So, again, two sides of a coin. Needless to say, Republicans jumped on this notion that raising the minimum wage would cost 500,000 jobs. Democrats jumped on the notion that it would raise people out of poverty, and the fur began to fly immediately. Also sort of interesting that the White House, which, as you know, President Obama has called for an increase in the minimum wage, the White House held a conference call with reporters shortly after the CBO report was released, to basically debunk it. Their argument is that CBO is using a wrong methodology, in effect, and that the impact on jobs would be much, much less because, oh, an increased minimum wage increases productivity and stops people from quitting their jobs and stuff like that. But it was really interesting to see the White House come out. Obviously, they're taking this very seriously and directly contradict the CBO report and say, no, they got it wrong.
Is that unusual that the White House would come out and comment on it?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's not unusual they would comment on it. I think what was sort of unusual was the, they jumped pretty much immediately to the phones and called the reporters and said, let's go talk about this. I mean, it's clear they're taking it very, very seriously.
So it sounds like this is a story that we will likely see playing out as the election seasons unfold.
Yeah, well, you won't have to wait that long either. The Senate Democrats are expected to bring a minimum wage increase to the Senate floor. I think the target date now is early March. And they, as you were hinting at, they want to force Republicans to vote against a minimum wage increase. Whether or not it is good policy, good economic policy, I do not know. But I will tell you that I do know that it is generally good for the Democrats. They think it polls very, very well as a political point. And so they want to force the Republicans to vote no. Republicans, you know, by and large, argue that it's bad for jobs, it's bad for the economy, it's the wrong way to go. But they also are looking for ways to, address the problem and kind of defang this. You know, are there ways that we can do well with other kind of cuts, maybe with other sort of rollbacks of regulations? Is there anything we do to offset it, find another way to do it so that it's not as poisonous a political item for them?
Paul, any sense yet if this report looks to change the future prospects for a possible minimum wage increase one way or the other right now?
You know, it's hard to say. I'm not particularly optimistic it's going to pass anyhow, because getting almost anything through the House of Representatives at this point is impossible. That is to say, getting any of the Democratic priorities through the House of Representatives is almost impossible. I'm not sure this changes that. In fact, to some degree, it's given the Republicans ammunition to say, hey, 500,000 jobs lost if you raise this minimum wage, and that's not coming from us. That's coming from the independent analysis at the CBO.
And yet you said the Democrats are seeing this as a pretty popular topic, one that they think people want to see championed. Is that going to have any bearing?
Well, I mean, again, I this is one of those conversations. Policy and politics are different things. You know, you won't. I'm not convinced we're going to change policy this year, but that won't stop us from making a lot of political hay over it.
Okay. Well, still on the topic of the minimum wage, we haven't seen any movement on unemployment benefits, a related matter there. Where do those stand?
Yeah, there's going to be another attempt to get something done, I suppose, in the next couple of weeks. Again, Republicans are looking for some way to move on this. There have been some talks about a possibility of a deal. You know, the issue here is the Republicans have argued throughout that they're not opposed to extending unemployment benefits, by and large, as long as they're paid for somehow. There should be spending cuts to offset it. Otherwise, it just becomes more debt. And whether there is some way to figure that out is sort of the next question. Can you? One of the things they did just before they left was agreed to extend or to reinstate some pension benefits for military retirees. And they figured out a way to pay for that. So the Democrats are now going to come back and say, well, how come you're willing to pay for, to use this mechanism to pay for military pensions, but not for unemployment benefits? Doesn't that seem unfair? So you'll see more of that conversation coming up next week. And it's possible that something will happen. Again, I'm in general less and less enthusiastic about the ability of Congress to pass almost anything, but it's plausible.
Any idea where that particular issue stands on the to-do list right now?
Well, my sense is that next week that's not on the House's agenda. They're going to be taking up flood insurance, of all things. The Senate, I think, has taken up a couple of nominations, so it's certainly not a Monday afternoon kind of thing. Unemployment and minimum wage, I think, will be first up in the Senate. I don't think they have anything they want to do on unemployment at the moment. So until we figure out whether the House has come up with some way to pass it, I'm not sure you're going to see any action in the immediate future.
Well, this past Monday, as we mentioned earlier, there's an interesting anniversary of sorts that happened, the fifth anniversary of President Obama's stimulus package. Members of Congress wanted to have their say on that and the legacy of it. What did you hear?
Well, you know, again, a lot of it depends on where you sit, I guess. One of the first things that President Obama did was get past this $800 billion stimulus package. And, you know, the administration remains proud of that. They don't talk a lot about it anymore. Some of it's old news, but they remain proud of it. And their argument is it stemmed the bleeding in the economy. It is clear it did not have the kind of rapid turnaround they were hoping for. They were making predictions about immediate reductions in the unemployment rate and a quick turnaround, and that didn't happen. It took years for the unemployment rate to come down. So to some degree, you know, they stopped talking about it. But now, 5 years later, they put out an announcement saying, look, we prevented a double-dip recession. The economy has improved, has bounced back. We're proud of that, and it was a landmark achievement. The Republicans said basically exactly the opposite, that the stimulus bill was largely a waste, a giveaway to a bunch of Obama cronies. It went into a whole bunch of goofball projects, wind farms and stuff that didn't really have any economic viability, didn't create a whole lot of jobs in the United States. I think what has happened now over the 5 years it's become less relevant. You know, I mean, I don't think anybody's going to be running on the stimulus bill in 2014 and certainly not in 2016. But it is an interesting window into what is your philosophy of government. Also, just might mention, USA Today had a nice story, we're proud of ourselves, on Monday, that turns out there's been a whole bunch of investigations of fraud in that bill, but very, very, very little actual loss, maybe $200 million worth of losses, which is not much.
What kind of losses are we talking about?
Well, people who, steered money to fake projects, people who applied for money to fund my other brother, Daryl Contracting Company, whatever it was. You know, these are basically fraud claims. When there's $800 billion on the table, invariably people try to line their pockets with it. And there's been about 1,500 fraud cases already pursued by the government and another 1,500 still pending. But ultimately, they're concluding that there's really only about $6 billion worth of the spending that they think was questioned, basically, which is a tiny fraction when you think about $800 billion worth. But there's a great quote from one of the Republicans. He says, okay, well, so you poured $800 billion down the drain. Just because you didn't spill any doesn't mean it was still a good idea.
Interesting quote there. So, hearing all of these things involved with the stimulus package and its anniversary, the fifth anniversary, which was Monday, it doesn't seem like there's a resounding yay or nay on how well it worked, at least in Washington and Congress. But is there a sense in the general public how this panned out?
That's an interesting question. You know, I have not seen recently, at least, any kind of polling that indicates that people really remember it. You know, I mean, this is a funny thing about how our government works is that we get all excited about stuff in brief periods of time, and then we kind of forget, right? I mean, this is what I meant about it's not going to be a 2014 election issue, I don't think, because people just sort of forget that it happened. There are still people, obviously, who believe that the Obama philosophy of governing is wrong, right? It's spending too much, it's racking up too much debt, and this becomes part of that narrative. But I do think it is clear that the American people feel, and this has been shown in the polling, that the economy is getting better, that their situation is generally getting a little bit better, and that the country is moving towards the right direction. I think there is a lot of sense that it has been happening too slowly, and still a great deal of concern about debt and deficit and stuff like that. But in general, the economic signals have been pretty good, and I think that to the degree that picks up any speed from a political standpoint, that's good for the Democrats. If people feel like the economy is getting better, that's good for the incumbent party.
Right. So it sounds like you've got a lot of people feeling that things are slowly getting better, but not a lot of people pointing at the stimulus package and saying, thank you very much, Obama White House, which is, of course, what they would like.
Well, and even the Obamas, I'll say for the White House, they don't say we did the stimulus and then quit, right? One of the reasons why it's hard for them to take credit for the stimulus specifically is because then they say, and by the way, look at the five things we did after that. We also did, this thing on jobs, and we also did this thing on minimum wage, or also the Health Care Act is having an effect, right? So there's all these other things that they say build on the stimulus as a foundation. It's not like we started, we passed that, and then we quit. You know, so that's why it's hard to go back to that particular bill and say, there is our achievement, there is our spark for the recovery.
So final question for you. There are a couple of representatives leaving Congress. Gloria McLeod from California is leaving, and also Rush Holt of New Jersey. Any idea about, you know, why they're leaving and whether it signals anything other than people just kind of wanting to move on?
You know, Rush Holt doesn't surprise me. He ran for Senate and lost, and, you know, now he's kind of bored, and there's not a whole lot of places to go up at that point in the House for a while. The McLeod one's kind of interesting. She's only been in Congress for 2 years. She's a first-termer, so she's really finishing her second year, and she's leaving to run for a county commissioner office in San Bernardino County, which it doesn't sound like a step up
right
on the political chart. You know, I can't speak to, you know, obviously everyone makes their own judgments here. Part of it is, in California particularly, if you are a backbench Democrat, you have no meaningful role in Congress. I mean, there's a bunch of senior Democrats ahead of you. You're in the minority party in the House of Representatives anyway. You can't really get much done. In state mm-hmm. government, you can represent more people
and
working for the state, you know, than you can working in Congress.
So, and we're going to have to leave it there. Paul, it was great to talk to you again. Appreciate it.
Absolutely my pleasure, Veronica. We'll talk to you.
That was Paul Singer, politics and Congress editor at USA Today.